I've been given free rein to speak on whatever I fancy tonight, which thankfully for you, I've actually asked the Lord what to say. And one thing I feel like I really want to talk about tonight is worship. And when we speak about worship, I know it's much bigger than just the songs that we sing or that kind of the acts of worship like communion or the times of like special devotion that we have on our own maybe throughout the week. But it's actually that I really want to speak, and I want to speak about these times of adoration and praise and thanksgiving to God. Like, and I know worship is bigger than that, but that's what I feel like God wants me to speak about tonight. So just really simply, let's go back, like, how do we worship and why do we worship? Just ask those simple questions, like, how do we worship and why do we worship? Because it is quite a strange thing. Like, there's not many places in culture where actually a group of people kind of get together and in a group and sing songs on a screen. We do that. It's called karaoke. But it is a bit of a culturally strange thing to do. And like, I'm not choosing this subject because actually, like, I'm a secret worship leader. I haven't graduated from being a worship leader to being a vicar. Like, I'm genuinely, like, potentially one of the worst musicians in history. I've tried so many different musical instruments. I tried the recorder. We probably all did. I tried the violin. I was so bad at the violin that my parents said to me, like, Anna, when I broke my arm, they said, like, Anna, little girls who break their arm can't play the violin anymore, because I was that bad. I tried the clarinet. I tried the piano. I was so bad at the piano. After 3 years of learning to play the piano, I still wasn't good enough to play grade one. So they said, why don't you do a preparatory exam, which wasn't really an exam because you couldn't pass or fail it. So, and then I just picked up the guitar and I became a Christian because I just thought that's what you do. But it's not my thing necessarily, but I'm starting to realize actually it's just core to our identity as human beings. And it's core to our identity as church, because we are worshipers. Like, as human beings, we are worshipers. And whether I'm choosing to worship God or not, I'm still worshiping. And the question is, where do we direct our worship? Where do we direct our praise? And the worship that you see in the Bible that God calls us to is a worship where we give our whole beings, our entire beings. And we're going to be looking at a psalm, Psalm 95 in a bit. And it uses the word heart. And when we think about our heart, we often think about our emotions. We kind of go into like sort of a Greek mindset of where human beings are split up into their body and their minds and their emotions. But actually, when in the Hebrew scriptures, when it's talking about your heart, it's talking about this inaccessible core, like, of who you are, which encapsulates your whole being, your entire being, your body, your emotions, your mind, your intellect, your moral choices. It's everything that who you are. So when it's talking about your heart worshiping God, it's actually saying giving all of yourself. And when Jesus said, you know, love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength and with your mind, what he was doing was using repetition words. He was saying actually words that meant the same thing. It was synonyms. It was like, give everything of yourself, give more of yourself, give every single ounce of your being to him. That's what God is calling us to do. That's the worship that God is seeking. And it is core to identity. It directs our center of our being. So I want to turn to Psalm 95 just to have a look. So why don't you grab some of the Bibles in front of you? And the reason I chose this psalm is because it very simply states why we worship and how we worship. It was also a psalm that was like really important to the early church. So it's quoted a few times in the book of Hebrews as they're trying to work out, what does it mean to worship this Jesus? Like, now he's come and he's shown himself to be God in human flesh. What does it mean to worship him in terms of, like, having been so used to temple worship and that understanding of worship? What does it mean to worship Jesus? And the first verses, 1-7, is kind of a very simple description of what we do when we worship. And the second part, verses 8-9, slightly more neggy. It's a bit more of a warning going on. But I think that's, like, why we worship. It tells us why we worship. So let's have a read. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands form the dry land. Come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. Today, if you would only hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did at the day at Massah in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested me. They tried me, though they had seen what I had done. For 40 years, I was angry with that generation. I said, they are people whose hearts go astray. They have not known my ways. So I declared an oath in my anger that they shall never enter my rest. And it's that second part that I just want to focus on. Some of you are going to absolutely hate this. You like things done chronologically. I'm going to start at the end. I'm going to go back to the beginning. I'm sorry, get over it. But this little bit at the end, these like last few verses, it kind of explains why we worship. And when it's talking about the people of Israel, it's talking about the people that were slaves in Egypt, that they were under an oppressive rule, that they were slaves under Pharaoh. And God chose them and he delivered them out. He called them out. And he, in the most dramatic fashion, took them out from under the hand of their oppressor. That they walked out of Egypt carrying riches from their oppressors. They were carrying the riches of the Egyptians. That they walked into the desert. And then God gives them everything that they need. He gives them water. He gives them food. He even gives them meat, which I would be very happy about if I was there. He says that it says in the scriptures that actually not even their clothes wore out. Their shoes didn't wear out. They had everything they needed. Yet despite that, we see this group of people turn again, time and time again, away from him. Despite knowing all that he can do for them and all that he has done for them, they distrust who he is and they harden their hearts. And you see that by them questioning, like when they're thirsty again, oh gosh, I wish I was back in slavery in Egypt. And when Moses goes up the mountain, they're so quick to turn and start worshipping a golden calf. And when they're talking about going to the promised land, he's given them this purpose. Like, I've called you as this people to have a purpose. And yet when that purpose is within reach, they question, like, can God actually do this? They forget who he is. And Hebrews would say to us when it looks at this psalm, Psalm 95, it says, as long as today is called today, don't be like them. Don't harden your hearts. Don't forget what God has done for you. Don't forget who he is and what he's done. Because if you forget those things, you will forget who you are and what you are called to do. And that is like human nature, isn't it? This forgetfulness. And I know a lot about forgetfulness. I'm I've just got a dreadful memory. I forget people's names and dates. But worse than that, like I'm actually, because I'm dyslexic. When you're dyslexic, you kind of have an air of your IQ, which is a bit lower than the average. Mine is my short-term memory, and like it is so low. I'm in the bottom 3% of the UK population. So basically only 2% have a worse short-term memory. That is how bad I am. But it's more, with the Israelites, it's more than just forgetting those details. It's that they forget the very, like, identity, and they forget their story. And we see this, like, even as we go back to Genesis, like at the unraveling of the created order, you see what's happening, and where it starts is that God's nature, God's character is undermined, and Adam and Eve forget who God is. It says, now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord had made. And he said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? Did God really say that you can't eat from any tree in the garden? What he's doing there, he's sowing like seeds of doubt of like, actually, is he really good? Is he really generous? Who is this God that you say that you believe in? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat from the fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden. You must not touch it or you will die. You will certainly not die, the serpent said to the woman. This God is a liar. He's trying to keep you from good things. He's a liar. You're not going to die. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will know, and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil. That word God is a plural word, gods, as if like there's more than one God, as if there's more than one true God. He undermines the character and the nature of who God is. And Eve's response should have been one of outrage. It should have been one of like, no, I'm going to recall who my God is because I know he's good. I know that he has created me. I know that he's put me in this place of privilege within creation to look after this earth as he would do. I know that he is good, but she doesn't. She forgets. She forgets who our God is. She forgets what he has done for her and by creating her. And therefore, she forgets who she is. And this is like the hideous tragedy of Genesis 3, is that she tries to start grabbing at something to become like God, and she forgets who she is, that she's already been made in the image and likeness of God. She already bears his image and his likeness. She's grabbing at something that she already has, and it's just this hideous tragedy. And then she forgets what she's called to do. She forgets that she's there to look after this earth as he would do. And any unclean thing, like speaking words, undermining God, that should have been removed from the garden. She forgets who her God is. She forgets what he's done for her. She forgets who she is, and she forgets what she's called to do. And worship is this gift that we have been given to preserve the narrative of who God is and what he's done for us. And narratives affect like our behavior. Narratives affect the way that you behave. So for example, I'm a 30-year-old woman. I've been trained to be a vicar. I moved away from home 12 years ago. I'd say on the whole, I've like matured to a fairly standard level, emotionally and socially. I have my moments. But when I go home, like honestly, when I enter back into that home environment, I just like, it's like all of this like well-functioning adult just crumbles away. Does anyone else have that experience? And I'm suddenly like this petulant child or like this angsty teenager, like just lazing around. And it's because I'm like going back into the narrative for that actually I'm the youngest child. And that then shapes and forms how my behavior. And we've been given this gift of worship to shape the narrative of what's going on and why we then how we behave. And the most amazing act of worship is through the last 2,000 years, it's formed and shaped the church's communion, where we start to enter into the story. And Jesus says to us, remember me. Do this in memory of me. May you never, ever move away from this story. May you never move away from this deliverance. And as wonderful as the deliverance of the Israelites was in out of Egypt, it is nothing compared to what Jesus has done for us. It is nothing compared to the fact that God chose to put on human flesh and walk amongst us. He chose to enter into the created order. And he poured himself out. His body was beaten. He was spat at. He was humiliated on a cross so that he could face sin and death. And he triumphed over them and he beat them and he destroyed them. The things that were holding us down, he delivered us from. And he promises us that he will sustain us, that he will not just be with us, but he will be inside of us. It is just the most phenomenal deliverance. May we never, ever, ever move away from that story. May we never forget. May that be the thing that defines us, that dictates our behavior. This magnificent story of deliverance. But if I'm honest, like, you know, I'm quite judgmental of Aaron and the Israelites in terms of thinking, you idiots, you're just so dumb. Like, how could you forget that quickly? But I know that's exactly what I'm like. I know I can read into that story myself. Because if I'm honest, like, you know, I became a Christian when I was 18. And there's been moments in my life when I look back and I think, gosh, do you know what? I lost it. And some of the most painful times have been when actually I've been in ministry. And I know, like Aaron, it's like I was leading people astray, that I was choosing to go back into captivity of Egypt. And I was leading other people in that direction too. And I can't tell you how painful and gutting that is. And I'm so thankful that I've got people in my life. I was taught very early on that you should have people in your life who you can be really honest with and who will ask honest questions to you. And in those times, like, there was a particular time when actually I felt like I was a little bit out of control. And I'm so thankful that I had people that whatever was going on, I was able to tell them. I was able to say, like, however ugly and, like, ashamed I was, I could tell them what was happening. And the most magnificent thing was they kept on saying to me, like, it's not about the symptoms. What's going on in the core of you? What's going on in the heart of you? And the truth was, I felt like I'd graduated from my salvation. It's like I'd moved away. That I was pretty self-sufficient in ministry and I could do it myself. And when you looked even deeper into it, actually, my worship times, my prayer times on my own were just non-existent. Everything that I was doing was actually a public thing. And I'd lost that time with Jesus on my own. And that's what was causing the chaos in me. I may be wrong about this, but I think I might be right. But I'm not entirely convinced that worship is necessarily for God. I think it is about him. I think he is the subject and the focus, the sole subject and focus. But I actually think it is for us. Because I'm not convinced that God forgets who he is. I'm not convinced he's forgotten what he's done. I'm not convinced he forgets who we are and what we are called to do. But I know that I forget. And I know that I need worship. I need to clue back into this story. So that is why we worship. But how do we worship? How do we remember? How do we hold fast to this confidence? How do we boast in our hope? Worship has a way of hooking us back into our story. Like in the first seven verses, it says, he is the rock of our salvation. It's reminding us who he is. He's the Lord, the great God, the great King above all gods. Everything that we see, he's made. He is the Lord, our maker, for he is our God and we are his people. It hooks us back into that story of who he is. And I particularly want to focus just quickly on corporate worship and what we do on a Sunday and why we do that and how we do that. It's the Christian karaoke I want to focus on. And some of us might have different feelings about worship. I, for one, I freak out when people start jumping, because as well as being not very good at music, as well as being dyslexic, I'm also dyspraxic, which means I don't entirely have control of my NIMS. So when everyone starts jumping, when everyone gets carried away and we start jumping, I've perfected this method of just bouncing like this and not actually letting there be any air between my feet and the floor, because I think I would actually cause damage to someone, probably myself. But I believe there's a reason why we sing and why we've done this as human beings and worshipped in this way throughout the generations. It's because it requires our whole being. It's like it requires the whole of us. And when we're talking about that worship, it's like the heart, the core of us. And there's something about the lyrics that we sing. It's important. It's so important, the lyrics that we sing, to articulate who God is really well. And to remember to hold on to those truths, particularly when we're going through circumstances when actually our experiences are conflicting with who we feel, who we know that God is. It's in those moments, actually, it's so important to declare that truth, to remember what he's done and who he is. And rhythm is a great way, because it reminds us that actually we've got to, it encourages us to use our bodies. And apparently this is what I do. I was actually thinking about that early in the worship. I was like, I do this quite a lot. But it encourages us to use our bodies, because actually it's really important how we use our bodies. Every single word for worship in the Old Testament had an action linked to it. Whether it was yada, which means to throw your hands up in awe of God. We didn't make this up as the charismatics. It's an ancient thing to throw your hands up in awe of God. Or barak, to kneel down. Sometimes I need to kneel down because I need to physically remember, actually, it's you I submit to. And it's using our bodies, because actually it matters. Our bodies matter to God. The music is an incredible, powerful gift in that it stirs our emotions. And sometimes it's good to be wary of emotional manipulation. I totally understand that. But also when I read through the Bible, I see a God who is emotional. And I know that I'm made in his image. So it's right that I should bring my emotions to him. And it talks in that psalm about singing for joy, allowing the joy and all the good emotions to come out, but also allowing the pain as well to come out. The good and bad, whatever's going on in here. And I remember a time when my cousin passed away, and he was really young. He'd just proposed to his girlfriend, and it was absolutely gutting. And in this happy clappy worship, I was just desperate with pain and anger. And I was carrying my family's pain and anger as well. And it wasn't pretty. There was mascara. I clearly hadn't learned how to use waterproof mascara at that point. It was snot everywhere. It just was really ugly. But I remember God saying to me, thank you for bringing that to me. That actually there was a sense of pleasure in my worship, even though it was raw and it wasn't particularly pretty. We've got to allow what is going on inside us out to express that to him. And the Bible doesn't allow us, when it describes this kind of worship, it doesn't allow us to compartmentalize ourselves and exclude ourselves from certain aspects of worship. It's saying, actually, you bring your whole self to me. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, and all your mind. And it is a corporate responsibility as well. It's not just that I sing. As when we come together on a Sunday and we sing together, it's not an individual act. It's actually, I'm reminding the people around me as well to worship God. I'm calling them to worship God as well. It's like we have a responsibility. If I don't bring all of myself in worship, and that affects the rest of the body. It's a corporate thing. And I don't want to belittle any feelings of cost that you might have around worship. You might be really self-conscious about singing. It might be that you just got a dreadful voice. I'm really sorry. Sucks to be you. I didn't either. sorry. distracted myself with my rudeness. It might be that you're self-conscious about using your body. Maybe you're dyspraxic like me. It might be that actually the circumstances in your life are making it really hard for you to sing some of the songs. It might be that actually you really struggle to express your emotions. I don't want to belittle that the costliness of that, but I do want to say that is part of us recklessly giving ourselves away to God. It is part of that, actually choosing to come to him. So that's why and how we worship. Why? But the question is, like, why do I think this is important for KXC right now? Why do I think that actually this is a moment where we need to think about our worship? Just a couple of weeks before I started at KXC, I was reading 1 Kings. And particularly, like, the first couple of chapters, like, just totally captivated me. It says Solomon is, like, dreaming of building the temple. He starts to build it. And there's this sense of anticipation building, and the sacrifices are made, like hundreds and thousands of bulls are sacrificed to set this place apart. And there's this real hope, this hope stirring amongst Israel that this was going to be a place where actually the temple was going to be the focal point of who Israel were. That all around the surrounding towns and villages, it was like almost like Jerusalem was their north. It was like their center point. That's what I orientate around because the temple was there. Because it was that place of worship, reminding people that actually he is the core, he is the center, he is the reason for our being. And also out of the temple came this like forgiveness. It wasn't just a place of worship, it was like actually what flowed out of the temple. They believed that like life flowed out of the temple. That it's just a place where people would come and they would bring their answer, their requests, and they would get their prayers answered. They would come there for restoration, they would come there for healing. They would come there for protection. And there's this bit in 1 Kings, it says, when Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and achieved all that he desired to do, the Lord appeared to him for a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard the prayer and the plea you have made before me. I have consecrated this temple, which you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. And I get a real sense, and as I was reading that, I got a real sense of actually KXC is, it has a purpose, that we are called to be in this place to bring life. We are called to be a place where people will come and find mercy and forgiveness. We are called to be a place where people will come and get their prayers answered. We're called to be a place that will bring transformation. That is who we are called to be. But there's also this caveat that comes in 1 Kings 9. And it says, but if you and your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commandments and decrees I've given you and go off and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I've given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will become a byword and object of ridicule among all peoples. This temple will become a heap of rubble and all who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, why has the Lord done such a thing in this land and to this temple? And even though, as I was as I've been reading through 1 Kings and 2 Kings the last month or so, I knew the end of the story. You could see as you read 1 Kings and 2 Kings that the trajectory that that Israel is going on is not a good one. That they again turn away from God time and time again. That this place of worship is not used as a place of worship. And they get distracted and they move off and start worshipping other gods, but then they come back again. And I knew where it was going to head. I knew that Jerusalem was going to have its walls burnt. I knew that the palace was going to be torn down. And I knew that the temple would be destroyed. But as I was reading it, it was like it hit me afresh of like, I just felt gutted. I felt absolutely gutted that this temple that had so much promise, that had so much hope, it was being torn apart. And it says this in 2 Kings 25, the Babylonians broke up the bronze pillars, the movable stands, and the bronze sea that were at the temple of the Lord, and they carried the bronze to Babylon. They took away the pots, shovels, wick trimmers, dishes, and all the bronze articles used in the temple service. The commander of the imperial guard took away the censers and the sprinkling bowls, all that was made of pure gold and silver. And it is just gutting as you read how the temple was just torn apart. This place that was meant to be the place of the presence of God. And I am so excited by all that God is going to do in and through KXC. And I was just so excited the last couple of weeks as Pete is saying, yes, we're going to push into this vision deeper. And I already see, I see people giving themselves recklessly away to God, to each other, to King's Cross and beyond. I see that. And I want to encourage you that I like having been a newcomer, I can see that. I can see the stories of that happening, and you should be encouraged. But as we press in deeper into that, I just felt this sense of none of that is going to happen if we take our eyes off worshipping him. If we start not bringing all of ourselves to worship him. If in any way we forget that actually everything orientates around him, it begins there. And yes, I want to see people set free through CAP. And yes, I want to see people come to know Jesus. And yes, I want to see prayers answered. I want to see all of that. But none of it's going to happen if we neglect worship and if we neglect coming together and calling, reminding one another, actually, this is why we exist. It is because who he is and what he's done. And therefore, that tells me who I am and what I'm called to do. Worship is an incredible gift that we have been given. And Hebrews says, like, encourage one another daily, daily to remember this. Yes, this is something we do on a Sunday, but also it's got to be a daily thing. It's got to be a daily choice that we're going to soak ourselves in this narrative, that we're never going to depart from the fact that Jesus Christ has come to us, has come and met us just as we are, and has set us free and delivered us and called us to be people who bring the renewal to others. It is a phenomenal gift, and it's not one that we should neglect. And what terrifies me is that God, it's not what I would do, but for some reason, he gives us a choice. He gives us a choice to worship him. And that leaves him extremely vulnerable, but it is our choice of actually, will we bring ourselves? Will we bring all of ourselves? Will we sacrifice something and recklessly give ourselves away to him in worship?